supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This week, we're going to talk about seed starting. Specifically, what plants does it make sense to start indoors, and which ones are traditionally and best planted right outside with their seeds in the garden where they're going to grow? It's not often discussed, and it's not common knowledge, so it should be lots of fun. But mostly, it's a phone call show, cats and kittens, and you know what that means. We're going to take that heaping helping at 1-888-346-9499. Samantha, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I'm doing excellent, Samantha. How are you?
I'm fine.
And where is Samantha fine?
We are in Garnet Valley, Pennsylvania, right on the Delaware line.
Garnet Valley? Did they find garnets there in the soil?
Not to my knowledge.
All right. What can we do for you? Sam in Garnet Valley. I love that.
Well, we usually grow tomatoes every year, and my husband uses them to make all kinds of tomato sauces, and I was just wondering what the best variety would be to use, specifically with heirlooms, because we usually just buy from the local nursery, and they're good, but they're not great. So we wanted to try something new.
One thing, if you want to get the best flavor from your tomatoes, make sure they get adequate soil calcium.
Okay. This
time of year, I'm always yelling at people to save their eggshells so they can put the crushed shells of a dozen eggs in each planting hole.
Okay.
And I tell them that's to prevent blossom end rot, which it does. Blossom end rot is totally a calcium deficiency problem.
Okay.
But tomatoes need calcium to create the full complexity of their flavors. So if you're not using a calcium-based tomato food, dissolving calcium carbonate tablets, or putting eggshells in the soil, your tomatoes are not achieving their full flavor potential.
Okay.
I grow a lot of paste tomatoes because, as you and I know, those tomatoes cook down into sauce very readily and easily. That's kind of why they were bred. But I also grow a lot of heirlooms. And
okay.
So I get some of the funkiest colored sauces of all times because a lot of the heirlooms are certainly not red. Some of them are pretty wild colors. But the flavor complexity I get from blending different heirlooms is just amazing. Now, I will tell you, you can strike a balance with a gigantic paste tomato that is an heirloom. It's called Amish paste.
Okay.
And these tomatoes are as big as a child's head. But they are plum-shaped, the pear-shaped, and they are very meaty.
Okay.
So I always grow some Amish paste. But I will tell you, I also always grow the variety called Black Crim, which is K-R-I-M. You'll see in catalogs, in heirloom catalogs, there's whole sections of black tomatoes.
Mm-hmm.
That are reported to be from Russia originally or something like that. Black Crim has a naturally smoky flavor.
Oh,
it's not a black tomato. It's kind of like a dark purple, like the black tulip.
Mm-hmm.
But the flavor complexity in these puppies is just amazing. And it's very easy to scoop out the seed cavities and, you know, not to cook your seeds because that makes your tomato sauce bitter. I've been doing more and more to keep seeds out of my sauce over the years. Now, you're going to get a funky colored sauce with Black Crim in the mix, but it's going to add a lot of flavor components.
Okay.
Of course, Brandywine is reputed to be the best tasting heirloom tomato of all time. And it doesn't always win the taste tests when they test like 50 different tomatoes, but I don't think it's ever finished out of the top three.
Okay.
So that's considered to be some of the most complex.
Great.
But my favorite are... and I'm trying to figure out what a great terminology for these would be in general. The variety I grow was originally called Georgia Streak. The same tomato appears to be marketed under the name Big Rainbow. As they're growing, they appear to be a yellow tomato.
Mm-hmm.
But as they ripen up, they develop this tiny little red dot down on their hinies.
Mm-hmm.
And then that red spreads throughout the entire tomato like a sunset. And it goes on the eventually to the outside of the skin, but it colors the inside so that every slice of the tomato is a combination of yellow and orange and a deep red.
Okay.
And for my money, Georgia Streak, Big Rainbow, Striped Marvel, you'll see them described as huge tomatoes that develop what's called a sunset blush.
Okay.
Just spectacular ratio of sugars and acidity. And I find that if you're careful and you just squeeze away some of the juice and cook that up separately, that even these big juicy beefsteaks can be cooked down pretty quickly and efficiently.
Okay, great.
All right, Sam?
I thank you so much.
Have a great tomato year.
Thanks, you too.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Brian, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike, how you doing?
I am doing just fine today, Brian. How are you, sir?
Doing well. It's great to be on your show. I really love your show.
Well, thank you, sir. Where are you?
Cincinnati, Ohio.
Excellent town. Excellent baseball town. What can we do for Brian in Cincinnati?
My dad and I started a small Christmas tree plantation, and we've been planting an acre a year. We're up to our fourth year. This spring will be our fourth year.
Mm-hmm.
We've been planting 700 Canaan fir trees and 100 Scotch pine and 100 white pines every year for the first 3 years. In the summertime, I've been noticing a few bagworms. Every time I go out there, maybe I'll pick off 10 bags over a 3-acre area.
That's not a bad number, but I hear you. That and you're scared to death of what could be in the future.
Yeah, and a few pine weevils. Probably 5% of my pines have them now, or two maybe. I just was curious about maybe introducing a predatory insect to make a good ecosystem so I wouldn't have to go to spraying if the populations got worse.
Well, you know, one of the issues here is you do have a monoculture. You know, you know, by definition, a Christmas tree farm is Christmas trees and some scrubby little weeds typically growing between them. So one thing I would recommend, this is a crazy idea, but I think it'll work, is if you have the ability to start your plants, some annual plants yourself, or if you can get a good deal on them, I would urge you to get a whole bunch of flowering herbs ready this spring.
All right.
And interplant them between your trees. And don't harvest them for culinary use. Let them flower. Because the flowers on many of these herbs, and you'll easily be able to find lists of the best herbs to attract beneficial insects, are some of the best attractors of the bugs that will eat bad bugs in general. You may find if you do this that the good insects will actually control outbreaks of other insects before you even have a chance to notice them.
Yeah.
The other thing I would suggest you do is I think you should hang suet feeders in the field over winter time to get birds used to nesting in there. And this time of year, as winter is changing into spring, all birds are meat eaters. They all eat the extra protein so they can court and nest and lay sturdy eggs and feed their young. So hanging suet feeders in your fields is a great way to get the birds to come in, get used to nesting nearby. They set up their homes nearby. And then as soon as the weather warms up, stop filling the suet feeders. And the birds are not going to leave. They already live there. So they will then scour your trees for bugs, not to be nice to you, but because it's what they do. But I would also talk to your local county extension agent. They will know the emergence time of the bagworm. In other words, for your area, they'll be able to tell you the approximate date or temperature range that the next generation will come out of the bags and try to feed on the evergreens. And then if you do a couple dedicated sprayings of BT on your trees, which is an organic caterpillar killer, you'll stop the bagworms in their tracks. You'll certainly get a great knockdown and keep the populations low. And then hand-picking and your birdies should do the rest. Oh, and in the summertime, very crucial, put up bird baths in your Christmas tree farm to keep the birds coming. Birds don't need artificial food in the summertime, but they're desperate for fresh water because most of the natural supplies dry up. That's the same advice to anybody else who has bagworms or fall webworms or any of these other caterpillar creatures trying to move in. Have some BT at the ready. Spray your plants. You won't harm anything else. A bird can eat that caterpillar after you've sprayed it with BT, after it's ingested the BT. It's just a good meal for the bird. But the caterpillar's stomach will stop working, and it'll be quickly dead. It's a tremendous organic option. It's probably a better caterpillar control than any chemical control out there, and it's completely clean. All right, Brian?
Thanks a lot for your time.
Okay. Well, good luck, sir.
Okay. Have a great day.
Take care. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and issue a final warning slash reminder to our listeners in the heart of the heartland that I will appear at the 16th annual Gardener's Palette event in Quincy, Illinois, next Saturday, March 5th. Hosted by the University of Illinois Extension, the Adams Brown Master Gardeners, and our local public radio affiliate there, the mighty WQUB. But don't go looking for all the details in the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with lots more of your fabulous phone calls and straight talk on which plants should be started where. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
You Bet Your Garden is made possible with support from Seed Savers Exchange, whose 2011 Heirloom Seed Catalog, offering nearly 600 varieties, is now available. Learn more at seedsavers.org.
You're listening to WHYY.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper. This week we talked to Chef Gabrielle Hamilton about her unusual and frank memoir, Blood, Bones, and Butter. And what do you think you should be feeding Fido? Well, you may be surprised. That's this week on The Splendid Table from American Public Media. Today at noon on WHYY.
And following Splendid Table, we invite you to join us for Fresh Air Weekend today at 1 on WHYY. Javier Bardem is our guest. He won an Oscar for his work in the Coen Brothers film No Country for Old Men. And this year, Bardem is nominated for his performance in the movie Beautiful. Javier Bardem talks about his life and career. And later on, Vidal Sassoon tells his story from life in an orphanage as a child to hairstylist to the stars. Fresh Air Weekend at 1 today here on WHYY.
WHYY programming is supported by the teachers and education support professionals of the Pennsylvania State Education Association, educating all children for a bright future. We are PSEA, providing the power of a great education.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up a little bit later in the show, we'll talk about which plants should be started indoors if you are a seed starter, and which ones it makes sense to just wait and plant the seed right where you want them to grow in the garden. But mostly it's a phone call show today, cats and kittens, and you know what that means. We're taking that heaping helping of your telecommunicated questions, comments, tips, tricks, etc. at 1-888-346-9499. Pamela, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike.
Hello, Pamela. How are you?
All right. How are you?
I'm doing just fine today, thank you. And where is Pamela doing well?
An exotic Upper Darby.
Okay, very good. Just outside of Philadelphia, home of the famous Tower Theater, where I saw many rock and roll acts when I was a young man.
That's right.
And as a child, that's where the Frankfurt L ended. At 69th Street, you can direct your shopping feet to 69th Street.
It still does.
All right, very good. What can we do for Pam in Upper Darby?
Well, I love to raise lots of different kinds of tomatoes from seed. More than will fit in my garden, I give a lot of them away or sell them. But last summer, I started getting painful blisters on my fingers.
After handling the tomato leaves and plants?
I finally deduced that it must be the tomatoes.
I probably completely agree.
And I'm upset because I hate to wear gloves to garden.
Well, I have a couple of good suggestions for you there. contact dermatitis is a under-discussed problem in all of gardening. For instance, when I was the editor of Organic Gardening, one of the most amazing things I learned is everybody knows that poison ivy is allergenic to a vast majority of the population. What I learned from a dermatologist is any ivy can cause a rash in susceptible people. And the thing about allergy is you're never allergic to a substance the first time. What happens is your body's immune system learns, and for some whacked out reason, the body decides that this harmless substance is an enemy. And tomatoes are actually well known for causing skin reactions. And this may go back to the ancient primeval tomatoes, which had a lot of almost stinging hairs on their surface to repel insects and herbivores. And I've heard from many people that they are unable to handle their tomato plants. So I have three pieces of advice for you.
Okay.
The first is I stopped using gardening gloves when I discovered batting gloves, baseball batting gloves. You can do all the work with them. They are the first gardening glove I ever used that I never took off within 5 minutes of going out to work in the garden. These are the gloves that I will go find because they're so comfortable and they protect your hands so completely. And I tell you, if I run out or if I poke a hole in a pair, I just go to a sporting goods store and buy brightly colored batting gloves. Brightly colored so that if you do put them down, you can find them again really quickly in the garden. You know, my second suggestion was going to be latex gloves. But now that I think about you developing contact dermatitis, I think you could eventually get a latex allergy. So I don't like that idea at all.
Okay.
But I do have an idea if you're totally gloveophobic.
What's that?
There is a product out there called Ivy Block. This was created for firefighters who had to fight forest fires where there was poison ivy and poison oak. And it's a liquid you put on your skin. And it's a clay. And it forms a barrier, a physical barrier. So you would put the ivy block on your hands and any part of your arms that would impact the tomato plants. You would put the ivy block on, let it dry. You could then go out and handle your plants with impunity. And before you came in, you would simply wash it off with a garden hose. It's available at all kind of drugstores and online. And it's simply clay, and it's been a godsend to people who are very sensitive to poison ivy.
Well, that sounds great.
And the nice thing is, if you protect your hands for a couple of seasons, the sensitivity may lessen.
Well, that would be nice.
And if you make a mistake, just put a little cortisone, just a little 1% cortisone on it, and that should soothe the allergic reaction very well.
Okay.
All right, good luck this season.
Thank you.
1-888-346-9499. Steve, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello there, Mike.
Hello, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing okay.
And where is Steve doing okay?
Eureka, California.
Oh, I was there just last summer. The coldest place I've ever been in my life in August when the wind was blowing off the Humboldt Bay.
Oh, yeah, it'll do that. Was there fog at the same time?
Oh, I almost couldn't get out. My plane was due to leave at like 5 o'clock, and all the people who live there just shook their heads, and that's when they told me that the airport there had been founded to try to teach World War II pilots how to land and take off in fog without crashing.
That's a story I've heard, too, but the Redwoods here love that fog.
Oh, I know. That's where they get most of their moisture from, right?
Uh-huh.
So what can we do you for?
Well, you had a caller recently who was had picked up some redwood seedlings in what he called McKinley, California. I'm assuming it was McKinleyville, which is north of here, just a few miles. And we've got some tree nurseries up there that he could have picked them up from.
Yeah, if I remember correctly, he had had a couple in the ground for like 4 years and seemed to be doing okay.
And, you know, I've seen them in odd places around the country that you wouldn't expect to see them. They do grow in hotter areas than we have right here on the coast, like southern Humboldt gets up into the hundreds in the summertime. They generally do get valley fog overnight and into the early morning, which helps to keep them thriving. And they kind of follow the river courses, so they're not too far from water sources. The one thing that you had mentioned, though, was that they grow in sand. And my experience, after having lived in Humboldt County for 38 years, and I've been a gardener for 35 of those years, is that they mostly grow in clay. Our soils are really heavy clay around here. That not only supports them, but it holds water for a long time throughout the year. That would be something that you would consider if you're trying to grow them. They can handle snow. We've had snowstorms, rarely, but, you know, along the coast, and seen them covered with snow, and it's really beautiful, especially the giant redwoods.
I'll tell you why I said that.
Okay.
And I may have misspoken. The first time I got past the wine country, I got north of the wine country, a friend took me into what I guess would be the southernmost area of the redwood forest in California, probably far below where you are. And I remember the area we were in was very sandy soil. And the person was explaining to me that without the fog every day and night, these trees could never have achieved their size. Maybe they couldn't have even survived, but they were getting most of their moisture from this fog. And I remember looking at the sandy soil and saying they must have, because obviously the soil I was seeing them in was not going to hold a lot of moisture, at least the part of the soil I could see. But I can certainly see how that was an anomaly, and I was just in a little weird patch where maybe the fog was the heaviest.
Was that an alluvial area, like along a riverbank or a creek bank?
I believe it was.
Yeah, you will find that if you dig down, you will get to that clay that is ubiquitous in California, or at least Northern California.
So that could explain why the tree is doing well in Pennsylvania, because we are blessed with abundant clay. And, of course, you know, we also have normal rainfall.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing that I was going to say is my experience with the coast redwoods is that they aren't a real good landscape tree. I've found over the years, I'm the senior gardener for College of the Redwoods, and that when they're planted in a landscape situation, the roots are very invasive. They'll grow up against water pipes to the point where they'll break them. I'm talking about plastic water pipes. They will grow into electrical conduit if the connections aren't glued. They will break tile drain lines. They're incredible, and they do uplift concrete and asphalt walkways and roads.
I guess they would have to because of their enormous size. The root structure has to be a corollary to the size that the tree wants to get to.
Oh, absolutely. And so my recommendation to anybody that's interested in growing redwoods in the landscape, I've had excellent luck with the Sequoia dendron giganteum.
The
Sequoia redwood, or giant redwood, excuse me, as it's called. It grows in the Sierras, the Sierra Nevadas, and it takes snow in the winter and extreme heat in the summertime. When their needles drop, they drop straight to the ground and aren't blown around by the wind, whereas the coast redwood can be real messy. We're constantly cleaning out drain inlets and, you know, cleaning up the needles all over the place. And the other tree that's really beautiful, it looks more like the coast redwood when its leaves are green, is the Metasequoia, the dawn redwood, that's, I believe, from Asia.
Right, and a prehistoric tree.
Uh-huh, and it is deciduous, so that in the fall it turns this incredible kind of rust red color that is really beautiful. If they're interested in that kind of thing, I say, you know, I haven't seen the problem with the roots with those. And you do have the leaf drop. It only happens once a year, whereas the coast redwood, it can, anytime you have wind, then those needles are coming down.
So you prefer the giant or the dawn for people who are going to fool around with this on the East Coast?
Unless you have a forest situation where you want to plant a whole bunch of the coast redwoods and see if they'll work.
All right, and you certainly sound like the man. What, your head gardener in the College of the Redwoods?
Yes.
Well, I mean, you're the man.
Some people say that, but I don't know.
The trees speak very highly of you, Steve.
Well, thank you.
All right. Well, thank you very much. You have added to our knowledge base. I'll try to keep that right up front in my cranium there for the next call about a redwood. Or maybe we'll just get Steve on the line.
All right. Well, I enjoy your show every Saturday, so keep it up.
Thank you, sir. Thanks very much for your call.
All right.
Take care. Bye-bye. 1-888-346-9499. Craig, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike, how are you today?
I am excellent, Craig. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well.
And where are you doing well?
Northwest Louisiana, a little town called Minden.
Okay, very good. What can we do for Craig in Louisiana?
Well, I've may have overdone my garden with organic matter. I had the opportunity to acquire somewhere around 75 bags of leaves and pine straw, and I put them in my garden and tilled them in, and was just wondering if maybe I've done some overkill there, if there's any damage I might have done, or...
Well, have you grown anything in the garden yet?
I've got strawberries planted. I have spinach, which hadn't come up. I just planted it in the last few days. I have broccoli, and it seems to be doing well, and then my onions are, they have been down, but they're just kind of dormant as usual.
And the leaves were shredded whole?
They were whole when I put them in, but I mowed them numerous times, so they're very well shredded.
I don't like the fact that you tilled them into the soil, because once you covered them with soil, you created what's called an anaerobic situation, and they're not going to decompose in the time frame they should. However, you have a very warm climate, a very long season, and your soil uses up organic matter, oh man, at least twice the pace that my Pennsylvania soil does, and maybe closer to three times. So it's not as big a problem as if you had lived in a cold climate. Did you till the pine straw in as well?
Yes.
Okay. What I want you to do in the future is, first of all, keep that pine straw separate. Pine straw is like one of the absolute best mulches for the top of the soil to keep down weeds. And so that pine straw, as you know, that's going to decompose even more slowly in the soil than the leaves. But it's so good on the surface of the soil. And on the surface of the soil, it will slowly break down and add nutrients. But as our listenership moves further south, I just hear more and more raves about pine straw. And it's funny because I get more northern gardeners asking me where they can find it in bulk. I think southerners are smarter because they use a tremendous amount of pine straw. And as you know, it's available commercially. It's available bagged where you are. And they don't have the wood mulch in the abundance that we do. And pine straw is head and shoulders above any kind of wood mulch for keeping weeds down and keeping moisture in the soil. And all that I would suggest you do in the future is I would mow those up, and then I would just pile them up inside a giant wire bin made of animal fencing. In your climate, even just the leaves alone are going to turn into rich black compost very quickly. And then I would even suggest you stop tilling, because as you know, or you may observe, a couple of weeks after you till, you get a big run of weeds come up, right?
I'm sure in the next 2 weeks it'll be rampant.
Yeah, and what people don't understand, because I think a lot of backyard gardening, when it got started, tilling was emphasized because especially people like myself have such terrible clay soil, it was a feeble attempt to make the soil more friable. But what we learned over years is tilling exposes weed seeds that are safely dormant, exposes them to light, and then they sprout. So typically, tilling increases the amount of weeds you have. And it's an extra step. It's extra work. So in the future, I would compost the leaves. If you want to make a really rich compost, add some animal manure or coffee grounds to the shredded leaves. But again, in your climate, those leaves are going to turn into compost very quickly. And then I would just spread the compost on top of the surface of the soil. So spreading the compost around your strawberries will feed them naturally. They'll love it. And then there are some people who say that strawberries got their name because the first mulches were straw. And you know, when you grow strawberries, your biggest enemy is weeds. Yeah. So if you feed them compost and then mulch all around them and lift up the runners and get as much pine straw underneath them as you can, you'll prevent weeds. And as you know, sometimes you can get that pine straw a couple of inches up. And then, you know, they're not laying on the soil, so you don't have nearly as many problems with slugs or millipedes getting into the strawberries. And they've got that airflow underneath coming through the pine straw. It's a perfect situation, and you get a much bigger harvest of strawberries.
Okay.
All right, man?
All right. Well, I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you, Craig. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind my fellow gardeners with itchy fingers and unfrozen dirt not to get too antsy while the soil is still soaking wet. You should always allow the top 6 inches of your doit to dry out before you work it, or you risk mixing up a soggy mess instead of fertile ground. But don't go trying to recall those radishes you rushed just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and which plants should just get started by seed out in the garden during the season. I'm seasonal Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
You Bet Your Garden is made possible with support from Seed Savers Exchange, whose 2011 Heirloom Seed Catalog, offering nearly 600 varieties, is now available. Learn more at seedsavers.org.
You're listening to WHYY. It's 11:38.
Mike McGrath, right back at you with local events. I'll appear today and tomorrow, February 26th and 27th, at the Suburban Home and Garden Show at the Expo Center in Oaks, PA. Today at 1, I'll tell you how to grow great-tasting tomatoes. We'll discuss organic lawn care at 3, and I'll answer your toughest garden questions at 5. Then tomorrow, it's a Q&A at noon and compost creation at 2. That's all at the Suburban Home and Garden Show at the Expo Center in Oaks, PA. And the Philadelphia International Flower Show runs from Sunday to Sunday, March 6th through the 13th at the Pennsylvania Convention Center, where I'll deliver my annual flower show lecture at 12:30 on Wednesday, March 9th. We'll post all the details at the events section of our website, youbetyourgarden.org.
WHYY forecast for today, partly cloudy skies. We've got a little bit of sun peeking through at this hour. High temperature up to 45. Tonight, overcast, the low dipping to 35. Cloudy tomorrow and milder, the high 55 for Sunday. Monday, rain ahead, chance for a thunderstorm as well. The high Monday, 60. Tuesday, back to sun and a high of 48 for Tuesday and Wednesday. A mix of clouds and sunshine, the high Wednesday, 50 degrees. Right now, it's 38.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a few minutes, we'll get to the question of the week. Which seeds should be started indoors and which ones are best planted outside? Gardening knowledge that's often missing from books and catalogs. And we'll get to that gardening knowledge and share it right after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Brian, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it, Brian. Where are you, sir?
I'm calling you from Brunswick, Ohio.
Where is Brunswick?
Brunswick, we're 26 miles south of Cleveland.
All right. What can we do for Brian in Ohio?
Mike, I planted tomato and peppers from seeds under grow lights. I started with fertilized potting soil, and I actually had them on heating pads or warming pads with a temperature gauge. My plants started off great. They germinated right away, but they ended up getting tall and spindly, real small. They looked unhealthy. I actually had to stake them up with popsicle sticks, and they were barely plantable by the time the 8 weeks was up.
Yeah, I have to advise people, as they learn how to start seeds, which is a completely different skill than gardening, If you raise Twiggy, don't plant Twiggy. Compost Twiggy and go out and buy your starts that year. I've already heard two things you've done wrong, perhaps three. So, seed starting, you start with a soil-free mix, but no plant food in it. People fail to understand that a seed is mostly plant food. Only a very small percentage of a seed is actual DNA that kind of tells the seed what it's going to grow. The rest is enough food to nurture it till it starts to develop true leaves, at which point, as you know, in nature, the seed starts to take some energy from sunlight and the roots go looking for nutrients in the soil. There is no advantage to having fertilizer in the soil when you start, and there are many disadvantages, such as a rapid, unnatural growth, because the plant is getting this food from two different sources, and it kind of goes a little blahooey. It's a very unnatural circumstance. The second, heating mats are only for getting the seeds to germinate. In other words, after you wet your soil-free mix that has no fertilizer in it, you plant your seeds in it, you put saran wrap or something over the top to keep the moisture in, you put them on the heating mat, which should be set to like 65, 72 degrees to keep even root zone temperature. As soon as you see the first sprouts appear, then you take off the plastic wrap and you turn off the heating mat. Because all the heat was to do was to germinate the seeds. Almost virtually every plant we grow in the garden can grow in much cooler temperatures than are necessary for the seeds to germinate. If you think of a 70-degree soil temperature, and in the real world that's measured a few inches down into the soil, that's pretty warm, and it takes really late in the season to do that. So artificial heat to get the seeds to germinate is a real mitzvah. You really get them up weeks, if not months, in advance. But then after that, the heat is the enemy. You can very easily cook the young plants and stress them. There's no advantage and there's disadvantage. So there's two things right there. Now, you mentioned quote-unquote grow lights.
I have the fluorescent bulbs that are supposedly outdoor green lights for plants, and I was raising and lowering them on pulleys. They look like a regular fluorescent bulb.
Really?
They're not the black lights.
Not the black lights. No, we're not going back to our college days. But no. I've seen a lot of plant lights that have a greenish tint to them.
These do not. They were white. They were just a real white.
How long are your tubes? Are they 2 or 4 feet long?
They're the 4 foot, and I had two bulbs.
Okay, so far I'm liking your lights. And
I think I did something wrong, Mike. One of my neighbors said I had the plastic container that goes over the seed plot.
Right.
And I had the plastic to hold the moisture in, and I had the tall ones. He said I had my lights too far from the plants.
I'm sure you did. I completely agree with him. And you did take that plastic cover off after the plants germinated, right?
Mike, I did everything wrong.
But doesn't that make you feel good now? Because now you can make some simple adjustments, and I think we're going to have some fat and happy plants, some short and stocky plants that are going to look great in your garden.
And I'm excited about it too, Mike, and I thank you very much, sir.
So you have 4-foot-long tubes. And are they 40-watt bulbs?
I don't know offhand.
Okay. Are they from last year?
Yes, sir.
Get fresh bulbs. Get fresh tubes. Even though they look the same to us, they lose a lot of their lumens over the course of a year. Now, those tubes can be used in a shop light in your basement, but get 2 fresh bulbs. They're very inexpensive for your seed starting for this year. Make sure they're 40-watt. But the secret, as your friend said, is once your plants are up, and I mean little baby sprouts, you get rid of any covering, get rid of any bottom heat, and then you keep the lights within a half an inch to an inch of the tops of the plants. And the lumens drop off just ridiculously after a couple of inches. So they need to be adjusted to almost be touching the bulbs. and you may feed your plants a gentle organic fertilizer after the first set of true leaves appears. That's not the little round leaves that come out first. It's the first sets of true leaves that follow that. Then you can begin some gentle fertilization. I think you're going to have great plants this year, Brian.
Well, I thank you very much. I'm excited now.
All right, very good. We should be excited. It's almost time. Let's get out there and do it.
Thank you.
All right, Brian, good luck. 1-888-346-9499. Joanne, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you?
I am doing just fine today, Joanne. How are you?
Well, wonderful in sunny Southern California. I'm in Oxnard, which is in Ventura County. It's going to get down to maybe 45 degrees tonight.
Oh, you poor things.
I mean, really cold.
You poor things. Throw
yes.
another governor on the fire. You know, it's 45 is a hot day here now, Joanne.
Well, I have just a T-shirt on right now outside, and I'm comfortable.
Well, you're making us...
I don't want to rub it in, but I have some questions.
Go ahead, Joanne.
I listened to your program on paper in compost because I've started using that biodegradable paper mulch. And I wondered what your thoughts were on using that and also in putting pieces of that ripped up into the compost pile.
Well, and is this a commercial product that you're buying from someone?
Yes, it's a commercial product. It's very stiff when it's dry. When it's wet, it gets very limp.
Mm-hmm.
And it's to be used either over the winter to keep the weeds down in an annual bed or to use as mulch, like you would plastic mulch, and then poke holes for the plants to come up through. I've been using it for weed control. However, once it gets wet and the wind blows, it doesn't always stay put.
Right. Well, typically what you do when you're using cardboard or paper to prevent weeds, you know, you kind of excavate for a raised bed of some kind. You put the weed barrier down, and then you put some fresh weed-free soil on top of that.
Well, this is supposedly used like you would cut a little X in it to plant a plant in.
I think you would.
And it says that at the end of the season that you can just till this into the soil, that it's completely biodegradable. So I was interested in your thoughts on using that kind of paper. It says it's made from recycled paper.
I don't have any problem using it as mulch. If you put even a thin layer of compost or soil on top of this mulch, it's going to keep it from blowing away.
We get those Santa Ana winds, too.
I recommend when the Santa Ana winds start blowing that you lay bricks around the outside as opposed to stakes, because I think you need to hold the outsides down better. Those
uh-huh.
winds are very drawing, too. So,
oh, yes. Well, what about composting this? Is this...
I would not. There's no nutrition in it, and recycled paper has often been bleached or had nasty inks on it during some part of its life. But I do realize that you have a great lack of deciduous tree leaves where you are. So I think really what you need to do in Southern California is make worm compost. You can probably have your worm composting bin outdoors year-round. Just make sure it gets shaded and cool during the hottest part of the summer. Feed your garbage and other kitchen waste into the worms. They'll make you some compost. And then outside in your compost pile, I would just compost your dead plants and old soil and stuff like that. For instance, if you have ornamental grasses, when they go brown, try to shred those up and put those in. Old leaves of bird of paradise that turn brown, shred those up and put them in. I've watched people pruning the old skin, so to speak, off of palm trees and stuff. Anything that's brown like that. So be creative, but once a green plant turns brown, it has the same compost-making power as a fall leaf.
Thanks so much, Mike.
All right, and enjoy your sunny weather, and I'm not jealous one bit.
Thank you so much.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week. seed starting? Which plants should you start indoors? Our question this week comes from Ashley in Southeast Virginia. She writes, Mike, I've been listening to your show for almost 2 years, and I'm getting ready to start my summer vegetables for the very first time. I have an average last frost date of April 1st. I've been studying your seed starting advice and the tips in seed catalogs, but I'm still unsure which vegetables should be started indoors and which should be sown directly in the soil come April. None of the crops I'm thinking about are early spring vegetables like peas or kale, but heart of the summer things like beans, tomatoes, cucumbers, and peppers. Can I start everything early indoors? What are the risks? Well, Ashley, the first thing I want to do is urge you to slow down your timing a little bit. April 1st seems awfully early to plant summer veggies anywhere in Virginia. And new gardeners often misunderstand that, quote, the last average frost date simply means the odds are good it won't drop below 32 after that date. It can still drop below freezing. And besides, summer plants like tomatoes, peppers, and cukes despise nighttime temps below 50 degrees. So think of your April Fool's date as more of an omen and a good time to put starts of cool weather lovers like lettuce and pansies in the ground. Wait until your nighttime temps are reliably in the 50s for the boys of summer to go out and play. Now, your question is especially welcome, as this is a major slip-through-the-cracks topic in the world of gardening advice. It's very important, but it is seldom covered, an issue we will now remedy. Let's do this by the seasons. Many of our favorite crops need to grow in cool weather, and they burn up or turn bitter in the summer heat. Ah, but their seeds won't germinate in the cold soils of April and sometimes even May, which are key growing times for these plants. So your first runs of lettuce and spinach should be started inside or purchased and then transplanted outside as soon as the soil can be worked. But later runs can and should be started directly outdoors as soon as the soil is warm enough to germinate the seed. Broccoli, another cool weather lover, is also typically started indoors so it can be transplanted out with enough growing time to develop a nice size head before the weather gets hot and those little buds open up, giving you pretty yellow flowers and inedible broccoli. Cut the heads off and enjoy them before hot weather arrives, but leave the plants in the ground. They'll produce lots of tasty side shoots, small heads that sprout all over the plant in the fall. Now, the timing of peas is especially tricky in areas where cold winters quickly morph into hot summers. It typically takes pea plants about 60 to 70 days to produce their first pods. So in my clime, if you wait until the soil is warm enough to germinate this typically direct-sown crop, you have a very short pea-picking season. That's why I pre-sprout the big seeds indoors or start them in peat pots. Then I can just plant the sprouted peas or the pots outdoors where the plants will thrive in the same cool weather that would have prevented their seeds from sprouting. Now, this is as good a place as any to explain that the days to maturity number on seed packets practically demands that you know whether the plants are generally started indoors or direct sown in garden soil. Because for historically direct sown crops like peas, beans, corn, and lettuces, it refers to the number of days from when you plant the seed in warm soil to the first run of pickable food. But with traditionally pre-started crops, it instead refers to the number of days after you put six-week-old starts in the ground. So when you see a tomato that's rated at, quote, 65 days, that's 65 days in the ground after it grows for 6 weeks indoors, plus a week for the seeds to germinate in the beginning. So a 65-day tomato really takes about 115 days from when you plant the seed until you can pick the first fruits. Now, crops that are typically direct sown outdoors are generally grown in rows or clusters rather than as individual plants. This includes salad greens, carrots, beans, and corn. In extreme climates with a very short season, people will sometimes pre-sprout their beans and corn to make sure they have enough growing days. But most of us can just sow the seeds outside where we want them to grow after the soil gets good and warm. The classics for indoor starting are the crops that are typically grown singly and take a fairly long time to go from seed to dinner plate companion, like tomatoes, peppers, eggplant, cucumbers, melons, and winter squash. summer squash, like zucchini, can go either way. The growth of these plants is so rapid that many people just plant the seeds directly outdoors, but you can start them inside if you like. Note, some gardeners in the Deep South and other areas with long, warm growing seasons have the luxury of planting just about everything by seed directly in the garden. And they're scratching their heads now, hearing those of us in the world of ice dams discuss indoor starting times. These folks know not the urgency and drama of a 90-day growing season. And finally, none of this is meant to make seed starting sound easy or uncomplicated. It is not. It's a completely different skill than outdoor gardening, and it does require special equipment, attention, and patience. Read our previous questions of the week on seed starting. And if it seems like too much work for you to do it right, buy your plants already started by the pros. Well, that sure was some good information on which seeds should be started where now, wasn't it? Luckily, you can read the print version of the question of the week at your leisure, or even leisure, at the Gardens Alive website. Just click the link at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Yikes, my producer is threatening to plant me in cold soil if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please tell us where you live. Please put the actual subject in the subject line. And please check first to see if the information you seek is already waiting for you at our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you can click through to the question of the week. Find the solutions to hundreds of garden problems, hint, hint, just like yours, hint, hint, in our alphabetized archive of garden answers. And or listen to this show, listen to old shows, and or download this week's podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week has been Fred Snyder. Rich Banowitz is our webmaster. His assistant Sarah Kazar rules the savage land. Our intern Jessica Mandick says, "Don't get me started." Alexis Landis, who produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, is always trying to get me to start on time. Our editor, Al Banks, says, "Forget start. How do we get you to stop?" You can't, because I'm the unstoppable Mike McGrath, and I'll sprout back up to see you again next week. Growers rejoice, the soil will soon unfreeze. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll discuss which plants can be moved around easily in the spring and why winter moves are a bad idea. Plus your fabulous phone calls.
The days of digging are just ahead. Dahlias, daisies, dill. Mike has advice on all and more for a dazzling garden. Join us Saturday mornings at 11 for You Bet Your Garden here on WHY.